With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, the word is out. They're gonna talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the gods will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out, it's gonna ruin the plot.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 644, Estella.
So close.
The DeVille Wears Prada.
Yes, that's it.
That's what it actually is.
Right, so, I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
I've never seen that movie, and that's it.
First off, The Devil Wears Prada is a great movie.
I've heard it's
you
really good.
You should absolutely watch it.
But, like,
it's a blast.
I know so much of it and seen the clips, and it's on my Seen It trivia game. I mean, you know, the dynamic between Anne Hathaway and Meryl Streep. So, like, I feel like I've seen it, and even in my review, I mentioned it.
Yeah.
Having not seen it, but I'm like, oh, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's totally the, you know. So, and one of the writers.
Aileen, I'm not sure how you say it, Brosh McKenna, who also is the co-creator and showrunner of one of my favorite
Crazy
shows of all
Ex-Girlfriend.
Time, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Yep.
I knew when I saw that, I thought of you, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is sad.
So, but let's go around the table, and we can introduce ourselves.
This is Kevin.
This is Tom, and Joe is out this week because I'm going on vacation, so we're recording on a non-regular day for us, but
it's
fear
sad
not.
He couldn't make it. I haven't seen him anytime recently.
Yeah, then he shows up because he left something here while we're recording. Like,
to add insult to injury.
Yeah.
He couldn't make it to record, but he showed up during the recording.
But we have a guest, fear not. Colby Mack from Colby Told Me is joining us. Hello, Colby.
Yo, 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 what up? It's your boy, Colby Mack, and I'm finally back on the Real Spoilers podcast.
Oh, so nice to talk to Colby. It's been a little bit, but you know, you never miss a beat when you're talking to Colby. He's just one of those guys. Everyone on the internet loves him. He's a great guy.
So, real quick, shameless plugs, and then we'll dig in. Don't forget, we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you find a podcast, you can find us. No League of Show Sharers, because this was recorded seconds after we posted the most recent episode, so you'll just have to wait, be patient. And but you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, check out the Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month, you get all sorts of bonus content, and you help us out, and we like you extra, so... there's all that. And so now, are you going to do the synopsisizing, Kevin?
No.
Oh, well, how are we going to do this?
Oh, you're just automatically out of the running.
I don't.
So
these things don't stick in my head that way.
Well, normally I would, and I don't mind trying. Colby might have a better handle on, you know, the plot beat by beat. I saw this movie over 2 weeks ago, so it's just not like
totally,
top of mind.
I saw it last night, but I don't.
You're like, I'm not doing it.
You know, real quick, backing up, talking about how the lady who wrote or you know, was one of the writers on The Devil Wears Prada. She has a story by credit on this. And I really honestly wonder if she actually worked on this movie
Or if it was so close,
or if the storyline was so similar, they were like, just give her a story by credit so we don't get sued.
I wonder. I mean, seriously, that's a good question, and I wish I looked that up because I didn't think about that.
Because what's the lady's name? That's
Anne Hathaway?
The Baroness lady.
Oh, Emma Thompson.
Oh, yeah. Emma Thompson.
Her character even has a not Stanley Tucci as an assistant.
Correct.
Oh, yeah.
Another bald
Mark Strong.
Another bald guy that you think is a dick that turns out to be the nice guy that's going to help her out, right? Like, it's
so Disney cut him off before any.
I don't know.
Maybe, like, cut them off and was just like,
but
we're kind of they're kind of moneyballing it like they do. You know what I mean?
So, but here's the flip side that makes me think that she did work on it.
Okay,
where I feel like there's an underlying theme of mental health in this movie.
Okay,
that is there if you want to drill down on it, and mental health was a very large component of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and was just a masterful handling of it. That the show was still fun and funny, and could kind of like made fun of that of mental health issues without coming at the expense of mental health,
in a relatable way.
Yeah,
we can laugh about this because it's so relatable.
Like, here are some of the foibles of having an issue like this without actually like making that person the butt of the joke.
Well, I mean, talk about that. I mean, to go off on a quick tangent, Inside, Bo Burnham's new special on Netflix. Did you watch it?
I have not.
Colby?
I've missed it. So when you say special, when I hear that word, I think of like a comedy special. This is a special and not a movie?
Some comedy specials are filmed kind of like movies. I mean, they've been doing that forever, where they film little bits or they film the person in their regular life before the special, and they get to the special. You know how they do.
Okay.
So Bo Burnham filmed, did all the lighting, created it. I mean, it's like an experimental film, but he did it all during quarantine. That's why it's called Inside. The entire film takes place in one room. And he does songs, like Bo Burnham is known for doing songs as a comedian, but he does it over the course of a year. And as he's working on it, he's like, I was going to try to wrap this up. And then he's like, but if I don't have this, like, this is helping me in my mental health and being trapped inside during the pandemic and everything. He's like, I'm just going to keep doing it. And I don't know when it's going to end. And it's amazing to see how he progresses. It is such a moving film because you can see his mental health as he goes on, and I mean, he seems to be doing fine. I'm not saying like it led up to some crazy incident, but you can see his mental health, like all of ours.
Maybe the point is that it didn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That if it hadn't been for how he handled it, it would have led to.
I mean, he talks about suicide
incident,
multiple times in this movie.
Yeah.
It is a really, really, I think, important watch because it's very modern. It's funny because he's funny, but the songs he sings about, while hilarious, also point out things about society and, you know, his typical comedy commentaries. But a lot of it's mental health, and it's something we can all relate to, being trapped inside. He just has this crazy creative outlet. I mean, in the best way. Like, he's doing all these lights. He puts on a show. He shines stuff on a disco ball, and he has all these colors. Like,
yeah,
he did the cinematography, the lighting. I mean, it was his project, and it was his way to deal with not being able to tour, not being able to see people, and just to watch him in these different stages and where his mind's at and what he came up with. Again, it's phenomenal. Go watch it. It's on Netflix. Just dropped about a week ago. Bo Burnham, it's called Inside. I'm sure it's going to be in the top, whatever. But that's another way that,
awesome,
like, it's interesting when people get an outlet like that,
yeah,
and can talk about mental health, but it's not just some educational thing. But stuff we can relate to, and we can laugh about it, and
yeah,
it can be fun, but also like, wow, like, this is giving me the feels too.
Yeah, and, totally. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I want to, like, we should, I think, before we get into the movie, and this is obviously going to lead into it, but I think we should cut off. There's so many people out there that are just anti-Disney, anti-live-action remakes, anti-prequels or, like, origin stories, all that. Like, you know, I mean, there's a certain person that when they see the poster for this, they go, that's an F-minus, one-star, terrible movie.
Hey, man, this guy.
Okay.
I had zero desire to see this movie.
Okay.
Zero.
But you at least give it a chance.
Yeah,
sure.
You don't come in with a particular bias where I feel like you'd be like completely, this movie's going to be devoid of you ever giving it a chance to
write.
Yes.
I try not to.
Zero interest is different than I'm talking about, you know, the internet.
Yeah.
Quote,
but
like the internet.
In fairness to douchebags on the internet.
Okay. Please, they need more recognition. Go ahead.
This movie on paper sounds like a parody of movies like this.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Like, anything that ends up being good before you see it could, I mean, on but paper
I,
be.
I just mean that, like, the idea of, like, oh, we're going to retcon another villain. It almost plays like the Paul Giamatti is Winnie the Pooh thing. Yeah. Like, it almost
wait,
plays.
What?
It was like a joke thing that was, I think,
okay,
something like that. Yeah. And so, like, it almost sounds that ridiculous because it's like, it's not like 101 Dalmatians is top tier Disney.
Right.
Like, in full disclosure, never seen it.
No.
I've never seen the cartoon.
The animated original or the live action. None of them. What's my guy's name?
Are you a Disney guy and have not seen one of the classics? I mean, that's just such a classic.
Is it a classic?
Yeah.
Like, I always looked at it as kind of like lesser than. Yeah. Like, it's not.
Like, Oliver and Company is lesser than.
Which for
101
sure.
Dalmatians is, I mean, of the classic, by I mean like one of the older original, but like top tier of the old. You know, it's obviously.
I mean, it's not a Peter Pan or a Snow White or a Dumbo.
I think it's up there
Really?
I think it's around that. Yeah.
I think
people put
101 Dalmatians, is in that category.
I always just thought it was kind of like that fallow period. So, like, I just never saw it.
You should check it out. I mean, especially the
Now I might, but.
Yeah.
Jeff Bridges. Yeah, that's right. Jeff Bridges, Glenn Close.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, so the live action movie.
The live action is definitely different.
I saw when I was in Florida on vacation. And, you know, after Disney in the parks, you know, long days out in the heat or whatever, of course, we went to go see a movie at night, and I fell asleep during it. So
I get that.
So I just rewatched it before Cruella so I could finish the movie finally. Yeah. And you know what? It has its merits. I'm not going to say that it's perfect or even like an excellent movie. But, you know, for what it is, they actually do a pretty good job. So
it plays better watching it during the time that it was released. You know, like, there's subjectivities to it that is, like, you know, emblematic of that particular time. You know?
But they do a lot of smart stuff, which they introduced the fashion designer aspect. Because when you watch the cartoon, if you watch the cartoon, Cruella is just a crazy lady who loves fur.
Yes. Okay.
I mean, there's no fashion designer
aspect
to it.
Okay.
So, but that came in late 90s, early 2000s? Like
95, 96.
Okay, yeah. Late 90s version. They introduced that aspect. And so what I really liked is all the homage to the cartoon and the live action, because people growing up taking their kids now are the ones that grew up like we did with these movies. And I liked that they didn't just scratch that, you know, get rid of both of them or just use one or the other or whatever. Like, they pay really nice homage to both and incorporate different aspects. And I thought the fashion designer showdown was one of the best aspects of the movie. I mean, I know it's kind of the whole thing, but what I mean is that that's kind of an original concept. None of the other movies tackle the fashion world except for, you know, they introduce it in the live action.
They give her a reason to want a coat beyond just being
a nut job. So I liked that when I watched the Glenn Close version.
In 101 Dalmatians, it was the live action was 96 and then 2000 for the sequel, but it was a hit. It made $320 million worldwide.
It is a really solid for a 90s movie. Look at it in the time it was made.
It was written, I mean, the screenplay is written by John Hughes. Yeah. Like, that's not
which I didn't
nothing.
Know as a kid, and I'm like, that's why it makes sense, right? Okay, so what I was going to say real quick is, cutting all that off of the, like, people are just, there are a lot of people out there that will never give this a chance, and on paper I get it, but they just go, this is terrible, and they just want to make fun of it for the lulz, for the memes, whatever. But this movie is not just trying to make you feel sympathy for an evil villain, because what this movie is so successful in doing, and what I think these creatives behind it are so talented in doing, is we know who Cruella de Vil is. Even without seeing the movie, you know she's a bad, bad person.
Yes.
She wants to kill 101 puppies and make a coat. Why would you ever want to see a movie that follows her when she's that evil of a villain, right? They have made Emma Stone's Cruella a really interesting character, and this is all before she would get to, if they even do, my guess is they will never go that route with the new
the
sequel.
They'll figure out an end run around
it. They'll never make Emma Stone do that or want to do that. So,
I think there's room for it.
Okay, hold on. We'll get there. But my point is, though, people are dismissing it, but this is not trying to make you feel sympathetic for a puppy-killing coat wearer. This, first of all, that hasn't, and I'm guessing will never happen. This is a study of a person named Estella,
right,
and how she could possibly deal with mental illness and become someone that might do bad or questionable things. So, you know what I mean? Like, Maleficent took place simultaneously with Sleeping Beauty. And so they tried to flip the script and tell you her perspective.
They tried to Wicked it.
Yes. And this is not simultaneous.
No.
This is before. So
And here's the thing, in case you can't tell, I love this movie.
I love this
movie. I did not expect to even like this movie.
Colby?
Yo,
he gave us a 10 out of 10.
I love this movie.
I'm telling you.
And here's a hot take.
Yeah.
This is a better Harley Quinn movie than any Harley Quinn movie they've made.
Mm. Wow.
So I'll agree. I'll agree only because, one, I think that Emma Stone is a better movie star than Margot Robbie, right?
I mean, Margot Robbie's good.
She's good.
Tanya, I mean, acting-wise, she can do it.
Oh, yeah. This is a better script than what we got in Birds of Prey. This is obviously a superior script than what we got in Suicide Squad.
But
what's amazing about this particular story, right? It's occupying this unique space where it's not a remake.
Right.
It's not a reboot.
That's what I'm saying. And it's not simultaneous with 101 Dalmatians. This is its own story.
It's almost fan fiction.
Yes.
Except it was put out by Disney.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. So when people go, how are you trying to redeem Cruella de Vil? She kills puppies. It's like, this woman doesn't.
Never once
does she kill a puppy. Yep. I don't know what she does in the future and whatever, but she hasn't done it.
And they even kind of address this in where she's making people think she's killing puppies.
Right.
But it's done in such a smart and snarky way in the text, right?
Yeah.
Where it plays to her character. It appeals to us who understand the historical context from other pieces of media that we've digested, but not specific to this world. Like, it doesn't just try to like completely throw it away, right?
Right.
But this film is essentially saying, give us the license to do what we want. We're setting up a brand new world. Yeah. Everything you thought of Glenn Close, leave that there. Everything you thought of the 60s 101 Dalmatians, leave that there. We're gonna pay some homage. We're gonna hit you in nostalgic feels at later points of the movie, but this is of its own. And I think that's where some of the critics who have lamented on this film get caught up. They have put their own projections on it because of like already making those similarities to, oh, it's Joker. No, it's not. Like, I can see some of the the similarities.
I can see why somebody'd want to go that way with it. And I think if it wasn't a Disney movie, the filmmakers might have gone that direction with it.
But the difference too is, they're jokering it in a way that it's like, how did Joker become the Joker?
Right.
This is how did Cruella become Cruella. But you have to kind of leave that at that, because
she
never becomes a murderer in this movie.
Right.
She never becomes a puppy killer. It'd be different if she did, because Joker, by the end of Joker, kills people and becomes Joker. And at some point during Joker, you have to jump off and you go, I don't like this guy. At first you go, man, he's down on his luck. He seems like a nice guy.
I get why he landed where he did, but I'm going to have to part ways with you now. Good sir.
And this movie never celebrates the villainy that we see from the character in other forms of media.
We don't. Interesting
enough, there's no really good people in this movie. Everyone in this film is doing dastardly things.
Well, and that's what we talk about all the time on this show, Colby, is how do you watch a gangster movie and root for the gangsters that are still doing crime, killing people, drugs, blah, blah, blah. But it's like
they're up against worse gangsters.
They're up exactly. Yes. And so when Cruella, when they pit her against the Baroness, well, the Baroness is way worse than anything Cruella does.
Oh,
and so you're only rooting for her to win against the Baroness. Now, when it comes time for Cruella to go up against Anita and Roger and the puppies, and however they formulate that, and again, I do think it will change drastically, but when that happens, you're not going to be rooting for Cruella. I mean, you know, there are going to be people like, oh, she's so great and what an icon and all this. But I mean, you're not supposed to want her to win when it's up against the good guys. So it's all relative.
Right.
And in this movie, Cruella is the hero. She's not doing, she's a down on her luck, trying to make a life. She's very smart, but doesn't get a chance, doesn't have any money. She sees an opportunity. She's talented and looked down upon and treated like crap and sees someone that has done awful things. At no point in time in this movie, even though they're criminals and we don't like people stealing stuff, but someone that pickpockets and someone who murders
and they're pickpockets who are like street urchins. Like they don't have a home. They don't like that's when you are introduced to these characters as children. That's their only means of survival. Yeah. It's not the same thing.
Necessity versus evil.
It's not the same thing as when Tobey Maguire's character in Cherry decides to start robbing banks, and you're like, F that dude.
Tom Holland.
Tom Holland, sorry.
Different Spider-Man.
Different Spider-Man. They're all this. Is that offensive? All the Spider-Mans look alike to me? I don't know. But it was... You know, like, but with these are kids. These are, I mean, they're basically, they're straight out of a Dickens novel,
right? 100%.
Like, it's, you know.
And so it's great that we open up with this film coming from a child's perspective, because for a lot of folks going in didn't know who this movie was for. I don't even know why we get so caught up with like, who's this for? Blah, 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 blah. I took
a good movie can be for anybody. Movie.
Right.
Yeah. It really can. And, you know, the fact that it opens up with we have not Cruella, like, because I always thought her name was Cruella. I was like, oh, her name is Estella. Good choice. Yeah. I was like, okay, I'm kind of feeling this little young actress. It starts out on a high.
You might want
right?
to rephrase that.
Okay, but it does start on a high, you know, this kind of pop punk, you know.
Yeah,
we get the voiceover and like, all right, yo, she's had black and white hair from birth, right?
Right, right.
And
born.
It's her recanting her story. Yeah. And it's kind of cute. I'm now am learning, all right, this is the adolescent years of this villain that I know from the future,
right?
But the masterstroke of that is it gets you on her side, right? Yes. Like, it's because you see the you know, the situation that is foisted upon her, and she's doing her best to navigate it, and you watch her make these choices, and that she doesn't have many choices, and so she makes the best of what's in front of her. And I also think one of the things I really liked about this movie is when she starts to make that villainous turn and really steer into, like, Estella's mm-hmm. dead and I'm going to be Cruella. Like, the henchmen in movies like this, you're always like, why do they tolerate this person, right?
Yeah, and I love the way they handled the friendship.
And I love that because she had built up a decade of goodwill.
Right.
And so
their family at this point.
So they're like, well, I mean, she's having a bad time, and I don't agree with this decision, but she's still our sister, essentially.
Right.
And at some point, it becomes too much for them, but it made these henchmen, where I haven't seen the original, but just looking at how they're drawn,
well,
I know exactly who they
you
are.
Know they're doofuses,
right?
They're incompetent,
yeah.
Nincompoops.
Yeah, and like, now I get it. And they even like kind of play their incompetence as a selling point, or like they're pretending to be incompetent to, you know.
Yes,
they're sucker punching.
Well,
you.
So
the old rope a dope.
Yeah. So and so, you know, just to talk about how it starts off. So Estella. And not DeVille, we find that moment later, the fan service moment later. But so Estella is born with the black and white hair. She goes to school. People pick on her because of the way she looks, but she's very rebellious, stands up for herself, you know, punches the boy bully who
right.
picks on her. Like, she's not taking any of it.
She gives zero Fs.
Yeah. Well, she gets lots of Fs in school, but she gives zero Fs for sure. So she gets kicked out of school, and, you know, her mother is just like, you got to chill it. You're brilliant and everything, but, you know, you got to go to school, and you got to, you know, we got to make things work here. And so once she gets kicked out of school, which was, you know, her mother is like, nope, I'm pulling her out right
well,
before.
Well, they even they even name check that other aspect of her personality. Like, she's two people. Like, there's Estella, but when she
they're sitting down, and I think they're like painting their nails. She's like, when you get this way, you really are more like Cruella. And I was like, oh,
yeah.
So
yeah.
It's almost a little moniker for her, where comfortably, I didn't know how far I was going to go in regards to like the mental health aspect. I was like, wait, are we really going to try to introduce this kind of like, you know, is this like, you know, a dissociative disorder or something like that? But like,
that's what I didn't know either. Is it?
Yeah.
I'm like, are we going for like,
it was riding the line a little
like,
bit, but
like, is it a coping mechanism, or does she really have split personalities? You know, I wasn't sure either. And I kind of land somewhere in the middle, because
yes.
I do feel like the one takes over. But as a little girl, I feel like it was just a coping mechanism. It
right.
was something, like, you know,
well,
kids create imaginary friends.
But,
and,
so we'll get the spoiler out front, which is the Baroness ends up being her mother. And
right.
the Baroness is clearly a narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so
and brilliant. As they
and
keep
brilliant.
Saying
and so, like, yeah. I mean, I think you can read this in a way to say that she inherited the brilliance and the narcissism. And she's trying to navigate mm-hmm. that with no knowledge.
Is that hereditary?
Of what's that?
Is that hereditary?
I don't know.
Those type of I don't know.
I mean, I don't know that they know for sure. You know what I mean?
But those, but certain, I mean, I'm studying with science with my son. We're reading about all the different
right.
traits that he passed down and stuff. So, I mean, there are so many genetic traits that are, you know, it depends on if it's dominant or recessive or whatever.
Right.
But I mean, there are a lot of things that are handed down, and I wouldn't be surprised if mental health.
Yeah, I mean,
were...
I know that, like, borderline, which is not the same as narcissism, but it's adjacent, and there's a lot of crossover in that Venn diagram. The verdict's still out. Like, some people think that it is hereditary, or at least that there's a hereditary component potentially.
Well, there's certain things in DNA where the actual traits aren't passed down, but if you have certain DNA, you're more likely.
Right. And then if you put that person in a certain situation,
it becomes
so more predisposed. Got
right.
It.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
Diabetes is one that we did. I was helping him with his presentation. And you're not born with diabetes, but they found that diabetics have a certain DNA, like two or three things in their DNA that they've studied that are all about the same.
Gotcha.
So people with those are more likely, when exposed to bad eating, less exercise, or whatever, to trigger that. So I would guess probably something like that without doing the research.
Sure, sure.
But it starts off as more of a like imaginary friend, you know, creating something to make you not cry and to be tough and to be strong. And so she has this cruel personality, gets her kicked out of school, and her mom takes her to move away. You know, we've got to leave town, start a new life, start fresh. And when she stops at this big party, and it is being thrown by the Baroness, as we find out, you know, my first thought was, oh, it's her sister. Like, yes. It's her aunt. The Baroness is the aunt.
Right.
The mom and the...
Like, yeah.
My first guess was...
The mom took on... The adoptive mother took on the baby is... Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And it's like, she's going to a rich sister. We need help. Why else would you go ask some rich person if it's not a relative thing?
Right.
And I'm like, I was pretty darn close, but it's... I would have never imagined it.
I missed it. Like, the mystery aspects of this film... I fell for everything. I didn't see anything coming at all.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool. But I the only reason I could even think of was, I'm like, well, it's got to be a relative. Why would you ask? You don't seem to be associated with these people. So she goes to the big party. Cruella has found a dog, and it gets loose during the party. So the mom says stay in the car, but she goes and chases after the dog and sees all the party stuff going on. And what eventually happens, the Baroness has these three Dalmatian attack dogs that she's trained. And what we see is that they're chasing Estella, and she goes out, try to get back to the car or whatnot, and she hides in this little ravine or ditch or whatever, and they jump over her, and it looks like they just miss her, but then they still go after her, Estella's mom, for some reason. And that's the big mystery of the thing, is like, what happened? And it's so... It seems a little ridiculous when you don't understand what happened.
It almost lost me.
But that's what everyone online is making fun of. But those same people will never watch the movie and give it a chance.
So I missed the whole Twitter thing where folks were taking this particular scene completely out of context. And
well, they just
haven't watched the movie.
Yeah, just posted it and go, how ridiculous is this that Cruella's origin story is her mom is killed by Dalmatians. Now she wants to kill Dalmatians. Well, first of all, in this movie, she doesn't actually want to kill Dalmatians. So that's not the point of it. And second of all, the reason that we find out at the end, and we find out the Baroness is the woman that the mom was talking to for money, she has a whistle. And when she blows the whistle, it means kill, whoever, you know, attack. It's actually triggering them. And she blew it on purpose because the Cruella's mother that she knows took her on when the Baroness wanted to get rid of her.
Not
not give up for adoption. She goes to Mark Strong
and says take care of it.
So that is who the Baroness is. So the Baroness, it's not like the mom was just killed by Dalmatians. She was murdered by the Baroness.
I will also say that's the sort of thing a narcissist would do, right? The narcissist would say, take care of this kid, knowing that it means go kill them.
And then if
there's ever any blowback, they're going to say, I didn't mean kill them. Why would you do that? That's the game that they play.
Which I'm glad nothing happened to Mark Strong.
You watched this only once. Did you hear the whistle on the first time?
I did not either.
Yeah. So once again, that little reveal, I was like, when I watched it again, I was like, man, I heard the whistle.
There was so much action going on.
And it's a really high-pitched whistle. So it's not something that's going to jump out at you because it's a dog whistle.
And it's a different perspective, right? So Cruella is panting. She's out of breath. She's trying to hide from the dogs. There's lightning and thunder out. The dogs are going, rah, rah, you know, gnarling and everything. And
I thought there were dogs attacking me in this room. That was such a vivid impersonation.
You know, I am trying to be a Foley artist, so I'm hoping that I can raise enough money to live my dream. But so you don't realize that, and that's what I love about movies when they pay off, or you can watch it again and pick out those
things.
And they
didn't cheat, right? Like they didn't cheat. Like that's the other thing. And I will say, on the first run through, especially at the beginning, I was just like, whatever, you know, and it was just like, okay, Dalmatians killed her mom, so she hates Dalmatians. That's a lazy plot device.
Yeah, they hadn't won me over at this point yet. But then,
as it goes on, like, even though I do think, you know, 134 minutes might be a bit much. I also think that, like, there's a lot of plot in this thing.
It did not feel like Army of the Dead. So this is a movie with a very similar runtime, right? Yeah. So 2 hour 20, Army of the Dead, 2:34, you say, for this movie. So
134 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. About
217 minutes. 2 hours and 17 minutes.
Yeah. So similar runtime, but whereas Zack Snyder put about 30 to 45 minutes of stuff that did not move the story along,
right?
This was a very big story.
This movie was in focus.
Touche. Every movie I watch now is like, well, let's get the bonus points.
Yeah.
So I'll ask you a technical question then. Yeah. What did you think of the CG on the dogs?
I thought it was very good as someone who's hypersensitive to CG and not a big fan of it.
There were a couple scenes with the Dalmatians where I thought the CGI was a little wonky.
It is. Yeah.
At the beginning.
Yeah. Most of the time when the little Patch and the other dog followed them around.
Wink.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hate those kind of dogs and they were great.
That dog was so cute.
When they dressed it up as a rat, because whenever we see a dog like
that was awesome.
My wife and I were like, oh, rat dogs. Right? And when they actually dressed it up as a rat, we're like, okay, you kind of got me.
And it's cute and they're smart and I really liked it. But a lot of times those dogs were CG and not in a this is dangerous kind of way, but more in a we need 50 takes of this. We're not having a dog sit there and do it. And it looked really good. Like I could tell, but I'm like, that's some good CG.
Yeah.
Now when they move, it's always the problem. Like when the Dalmatians are running through the house, I was like, what are we doing here? You know, so
there was one scene where the dogs were all three of them were on the couch and it just looked I thought I was watching the live action Marmaduke. It was pretty rough.
So that rough, you say.
Oh yeah, that was an accent. Yeah.
So this is where I go back to the 96 version and they used real animals for almost everything. There's a scene where like puppies are going down a slide trying to escape whatever. 96 animation looked awful, probably was okay at the time, but to their credit, it's one of those movies where like a Dr. Doolittle, old Dr. Doolittle movies where they would use real trained animals, and it's like the whole time and they're not talking, it's just the, you know, live action animals where you can infer what they're thinking and doing, and it's really cute. You know, so I miss that, but I also realize in this day and age, if you use live animals, you're going to get protests. You're going to get, you know, animal rights because, you know, this is cruel and long hours and they could get hurt and all that. And there's also just shots that are hard to get. So I've kind of accepted, even though I'm not a huge fan of it, that, you know, it's been 20 years now. We're going to get CG stuff like this. And it's good for the most part.
And, you know, if you can make the lions and Lion King look like that, you can make some dogs.
I'll tell you what, man, that Lion King stuff is incredible. And I think that technology has definitely helped them get better. And hopefully we'll see more of that level. Because, I mean, if there's one thing I can say about the Lion King, as terrible, that's probably my least favorite live action remake. But if there's one thing I can say, it's, man, those animals. I mean, that's...
Wait, you like that less than Aladdin?
Aladdin's grown on me. It's not great. I still don't think it's great movie.
It's so much fun.
But I'll tell you what. I told you. I even said in the time of the review, when Prince Ali happens on, that movie starts, and it's fun.
Yes.
I just thought the lead up to it was like, good God, what is this? But Prince Ali forward, man, we're on for a fun ride. So, and that Lion King was just drab. It lost the fun and emotions. And anyway. So she meets up with Horace and Jasper. And both of the other versions, the main versions, and there's cartoons, it's all the same. They're nincompoops, right? She's just their henchmen. They're cronies. They're dumb. So in this movie, they're really, really good grifters. Like, they are, I mean, these guys are good. And so the adults, Horace is Paul Walter Hauser, and Jasper is...
Joel Fry.
Yeah. And they are both phenomenal. I mean, I've liked Paul Walter Hauser for a long time, and I thought Joel Fry, I'm not familiar
this
with
is the
him.
Best I've seen him in anything.
Well, I'm not familiar with him, and he's
Game of Thrones. He's the slaver assistant to Khaleesi when she after she goes to Slaver's Bay and frees all of the
he's not Grey Worm. He's not her captain.
No, he's like the guy, like the gold drape. He's like the intermediary for the old slavers.
Okay. Well,
he was supposed to marry her and it didn't work out.
Colby, if I don't remember something from Game of Thrones, let's be very clear. I have gone to the real Men in Black. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this here, and had them erase my memory of all things Game of Thrones. So I at least have an excuse there. But Joel Fry is so charming and so charismatic. Yes. So this is really the first time I noticed him, and I thought he was great. I'm like, put Joel Fry in
He's
everything.
Awesome.
He
Bro, I want phenomenal. The spinoff film of of Horace and Jasper.
Oh, they could totally pull off a film of their heists and things. And,
yeah.
But anyway, so they are really good at what they do. And I think it's really cool that they didn't just go, oh, put some numbskulls in. Because in the live action, even it was
right.
Hugh Laurie, you know, doing his more yep. comedy stuff that gotcha. He was known for before House and all that. And another guy, I don't even know, but they're just idiots, right? And in this one, they're pulling off heists. They play dumb for certain things, but they really are good at what they do. And I like that it wasn't like just, you know, oh, Cruella has these two guys that she runs all over and all this. Like, they were close family, like we said. They grew up together. They were partners. And only when Cruella gets into that character does she start acting differently. And they notice it and they address it, which is nice that it's not just like, oh, well, how do you explain how she goes from being family to evil? And they're just like, oh, yes, ma'am, and being goofuses. It's like, no, they notice it. You know, Jasper's like, okay, like, you need to, like, calm down. Like, we're, you know, think who you're talking to here.
Right.
Like, I like how they address it, and they only go on with it over time, like Tom said, because it's like, well, they're family, and they've always been there for each other. And, you know, we see that progression of their character as opposed to just, you know, henchmen in these movies are always just so disposable. Like,
totally.
Why?
Yeah. Or
why do they like this person?
Or they're just a comic relief.
Yeah, but why, right? You ask yourself, why would you be with such a mean, horrible person, and what do you get out of this? But when it's kind of like an abusive relationship or something, you know, like...
Well, and like I said, they got a lot of goodwill built up. Like, she hasn't always been this way.
He loves her, too. And I love the fact that we did not tread in that territory of, like, a will they, weren't they. Even though it comes close in one particular scene, it is there. But I always read it the entire time as a brother and sister relationship.
Agreed. Yeah.
He's the one... Their grifting is pretty successful. And he recognizes that this is not her dream. And he's the one that says, yo, I've saved up money from our you know... little montage we get of like how inventive the costumes and everything are that they're playing is so much fun, and he's the one that wants to get her into this space to be able to get a job, you know, walking along her dream.
And well, he's the one that keeps saying when the other one's like, what's the angle, like,
what's the angle,
we're gonna steal something from this department store. No, we're not.
No.
Like, she's gonna get a job, and I got faith that even though she's scrubbing floors, she's gonna work her way up. And so no, there is the angle is she's gonna work hard and succeed.
Yeah.
And you know, which was nice as well. And
it was a really nice relationship.
And they never did like I think a lesser movie, it would have been like they finally cave and against their better judgment decide to steal something from the store, and then that's the causes of falling out. Like, that's the lazy way to go. And they did not do
that.
They
never go down the road
they
of
never go
they're
the lazy
broken
way.
Up, they're not friends, and they have to come back together for in the end or whatever. No, they go past a lot of tropes in those conventions we see all the time. And it's just a really nice relationship until Cruella becomes Cruella. And really what unlocks that is, like Tom said, she gets a job at the department store. She's sick of her job. She's like a janitor, basically. And she ends up, you know, because she creates all these costumes for them and fashion is her passion, she doesn't, like, overnight gets drunk and just totally rearranges.
She pulls a mannequin.
Yeah, right. And then, you know, she wakes up and she creates this awesome, trendy fashion thing. Like, it looks crazy to the untrained eye, but in the fashion world, this type of stuff is like, whoa, you know. And the Baroness walks in. She's a famous designer that shops at this upscale store. And she's like, you know, does she work here? And, you know, the snobby guy's like, oh, not anymore. She's just fired. She's like, you're an idiot. She's the most talented person here. And so Baroness gives her a job. She starts working for her. And the Baroness is the Meryl Streep character. Mm-hmm. Again, not having seen the movie, that's what she is.
Totally.
And she's the Anne Hathaway, meaning Emma Stone's Estella. And she works for her. Estella has all the best ideas. They start to get really close. And she becomes basically her, like, assistant, like her person.
She's the standout out of all the people that are working inside the house, right?
Yeah.
Those house designers.
Right.
And if anything, I kind of challenge a little bit. She wouldn't be the Anne Hathaway. She would be the Emily Blunt character, the person who this has always been her dream. And granted, you haven't seen the movie, but like, she's so fashion forward. The way that she thinks, she's years ahead. Her own personal wardrobe that she wears every day to just the design house is like just completely different. Everybody is kind of stuck in like this transition between the late 60s and early 70s. And she's like in the mid 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, she's embracing punk culture in 1974. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is also, like, we would be remiss to not mention it or even go through it. The soundtrack for this movie.
The
costumes are a whole nother level, too.
Nicholas Britell is out of this world. I've heard this said before in another podcast, and I will champion it. he will be the next greatest, you know, composer of all times. He will be John Williams.
Well, this movie is phenomenal. Not only the score, but the amount of music. You wonder. So this movie has about the budget of Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah.
200 million. Remember, those movies combined were 500 million.
Okay, yeah.
So Cruella has about the budget of an Avengers
half
movie.
Of that's music.
And licensing music.
Yeah, I mean, there's two Rolling Stone songs in this movie. There's a Zeppelin.
Disney said, here's my credit card.
Yeah, there's a Zeppelin song. It's a cover, but you still got to pay it.
I know some of them are just mechanical rights.
Right.
You know?
Like, yeah, totally. There's a Beatles, but that still ain't cheap.
But the Beatles were mechanical too, right?
Right, the Beatles was a cover as well. But like, but
totally, I get it.
But
like,
there are some... stupid expensive songs in this movie.
I would also love to know
the opening song is Bloody Well Right by Supertramp, and like that's like the F word in England.
Oh, because bloody?
Bloody is, yeah. And so I'm curious
to
know.
They say that in so many movies though that like I feel like are even kids' movies where that would you would never even translate.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought
Potter
that.
And yeah, look, Ron Weasley, bloody hell!
Right. They
right?
say that all the time to kids because that just seems like the
yeah. I don't know.
Thing,
I thought that was like something like you couldn't say on TV over there. So I don't know. I was just curious like how they would handle that.
No, that's interesting.
Maybe I'm wrong.
But this soundtrack is phenomenal. Yes, and so if you wonder why the budget, I mean, sure, Emma Stone probably got 20, 25 million or something crazy, but and Emma Thompson got a big portion, I'm sure as well. But seriously, half of it's got to be music licensing.
Yeah,
and they are. Great. And I don't mean to keep harkening back to like Army of the Dead and Zack Snyder stuff because before this and
we saw them so close together.
I know. But we just were talking about how every needle drop in Army of the Dead is like just bad.
Right.
And this movie, every time a needle drop comes on, you're just like, holy crap, wall to wall, amazing needle.
You're like
drops.
Running to Spotify to be like, oh yeah. I'd like to add that.
Yeah, I have my SoundHound going the entire time. It's like it's stuff that I know, but I don't know by name.
Oh
I'm
my
like,
God.
I'm gonna make my way back to this.
It.
And the use of I want to be your dog, like that. Like normally, like if like when Zack Snyder,
like Zombie,
all of his songs are too on the nose. Yeah. Where their songs are almost never on the nose, but when they are, like that's perfect. Especially because one, it's not a song you hear in movies a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect song from that era to show the direction that pop culture was trending and how she was moving ahead of it. Like, so, I mean, so it, even though it's cutesy because it says dog in the title, like it's still like it checks a lot of other boxes too.
But you
it's
also,
just such a smart movie.
But yes, the editing. Okay, it's a great looking movie. Mm-hmm. The cinematography is great. The editing and the pacing for being a long movie is great. And so, and then when you have great needle drops end to end, and so when you get to something like that, the movie's been so good and it handles it so well that you're
it's
not
earned.
Cut off. It's earned and it doesn't throw you off guard because. Time after time, well, that song wasn't in it, but every single time a needle drop would happen, I'm just like, holy crap, that's a hit, first of all. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't just a random song. That's a hit, and that's not cheap. And I'm like, it worked with the scenes, right? It just felt nothing was out of place about it. So that was great. And then, yes, the costumes, Colby. And I was so saddened to read the article about the costume designers. Did you hear about the designers union thing that was going on? So, I mean, it's not finished and hopefully it will be addressed, but basically, you know, the fashion is this movie, right? They wrap it around two fashion designers going head to head and Cruella, of course, spoilers, comes out ahead of it. And, you know, they want to license some of these, outfits for like kids' costumes and dolls and things. And this is an Oscar winning, designer. A two-time Oscar-winning designer. Let me look up the name because I don't want to not mention her name, but I was reading this article yesterday. Costume designed by Jenny Beavan and Tom Davies. So I believe it's Jenny. Oh, he just did eyewear. So Jenny Beavan, she is a two-time Oscar winner with another 19 wins and 55 nominations. She won an Oscar for Mad Max. Her other win was for A Room with a View in 1985. But she's been Oscar nominated throughout her career and, you know, at least 10 times. She's brilliant with costumes. And so anyway, these designs, these crazy designs that you've seen, if you haven't seen the movie and you've seen the previews, obviously they're all over because the movie's full of them. I mean, she designed these, right? And so when Disney releases a line of dolls or kids' costumes or whatever, she's like, that's news to me.
Right.
And that's her, like, I mean, I know she's hired by Disney, but also she's a pro and it's her intellectual, you know, whatever. And so,
well, it's also interesting that, like, that's literally a plot point in this movie, right?
Right. Yeah. We're stealing. Yeah.
When she's like, well, she's like, I drew this at my lunch sitting in an alley. You work for me. It's out of your head. I own it.
Yep.
And like, and that's supposed to be a kind of a sign that she's a villain.
Yikes.
And then Disney's doing the literally same thing to the person that designed.
So I hope they resolve
it. Not a good look.
So she won the Oscar for Mad Max Fury Road, and she's working on the next Furiosa, the next Mad Max movie right now. So she's a brilliant designer. She's done all sorts of movies from King's Speech, Gosford Park. So she's done like that kind of period in,
right.
in like, you know, fancy dress.
And also like this movie has to have like 10 times the costumes of a regular movie.
Right, because it is a movie about costumes.
Right, like, and because there's so... And it's not, like, I would think this is a very difficult movie to create costumes for because, like, if you're doing Gosford Park, not to take away from this woman's talent, but you're like, okay, I need to recreate the look of this era.
Yeah.
She's creating the look of this film. Like, she's as much responsible for the look of this film as the director or or the cinematographer. So it's like if those dresses didn't look believably high fashion,
this
movie would be ridiculous.
Right. So credit
to her.
It'd
be like an Olsen twins movie.
Right. Credit to her. So I really hope they get that all resolved because, I mean, yeah, they are her creations. And even though she's hired, it's still, I mean, if you create something on that level and you're hiring an Oscar-winning expert like that, I would hope that you cut them in on some of the whatever. But anyway.
I can imagine it's got to be an interesting gray area, you know?
Right,
I kind of get it, but at the same time, I know, like, one, my daughter, she was just playing, because she wants to be a fashion designer, makeup artist, singer, right? Like, that's what she wants to be. And she, every piece, I mean, and I love that we get this transition because, yo, Estella was Estella. She did not switch to Cruella until she had a justifiable reason to do that. And it worked out well. And when she becomes Cruella, that's when her mind kind of goes crazy. She teams up with the Artie guy from that secondhand store and stuff like that. And she just goes wild with her imagination and all of her fashion stunts. That's where the fashion gets upticked even more.
Right, right. Yeah. So she's working closely with the Baroness. And then she realizes the Baroness is wearing the necklace that her mother gave her. And she lost during the whole craziness with the dogs and her mother dying and everything. And so she realized, you know, where'd you get that? And then she's like, oh, I used to have someone that worked for me and they stole it, talking about her adoptive mother, as we come to find out. And Estella's just like, of course, no, BS. Like, there's no
way. I love that line. No, she didn't. Yeah. Wait, I'm sorry. I have trouble with enunciating. No, she didn't.
That was good. And that's like, Emma Stone. I mean, Emma Stone is so good at delivering lines in a way, you know, whether it's La La Land, which I love. I know, Colby, you're a big fan of La La Land.
Big fan of La La Land, absolutely.
I mean, she is an actor that Crazy Stupid Love, right?
Mm-hmm.
She takes a line on the paper, I mean, as really good actors do, but she's one of them where she can do a line reading that is so superb and just you just fall in love with that character because she's so good at it. And that's what you get with Emma Stone. You get that personality.
I don't think I've seen a bad, outside of Aloha, and I don't think Aloha was her fault.
Well,
she's been like, great at everything.
I haven't seen Aloha, but is Aloha bad or is Aloha insensitive? Right, like, you know what I mean?
It's insensitive, like, but it's also a mediocre film.
Is it? Okay, like, and I legit haven't seen it, so I have no idea.
Isn't she supposed to be playing an Asian
She's
person?
Supposed to be playing someone who's like half Asian. And so it caught a lot of flack, and then it just kind of floundered upon opening because everybody was just kind of like, ugh.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know how much of that was because of that and how much of that was because it wasn't very good.
But I mean, even when she was in Superbad, or like, especially with Easy A, right? Like,
Easy A is amazing in everything she does. You're right. I mean, to his point, I don't think I've ever seen Emma Stone be bad. It doesn't matter if she's been in a mediocre film, which a lot of them are not mediocre, but if she even is, like, Aloha, I imagine, it's like, she's not the problem. So you're right. But she's fantastic. So she finds out the Baroness killed her mother because then she finds that she has the silver whistle, and there's a flashback and she realizes the Baroness had the whistle at the time when the dogs attacked.
You hear the whistle finally. It's more magnified this time.
Right.
Because we see it in a different perspective.
Exactly. So when we see the scene from the Baroness's point of view, she blew the whistle. The dogs attacked to kill like she's trained them to do. And so the Baroness murdered her adoptive mother. At this point, we don't know that she's the Baroness's daughter. That's a much later on reveal. But so now now it's personal, and Cruella is going to start to come out. So, you know, she starts to, like you said, she teams up with Artie, who is like, he has like an old, like, I want to say it's like our vintage clothes store equivalent for like higher fashion, but it's like a vintage shop from, let's say, the 60s. And so now she's going to take these 60s designs and jazz them up and turn them into 70s and all that. So she teams up with him, and he becomes her accomplice because she starts to sabotage what the Baroness is doing to get even. She wants to ruin her. She wants to, you know, she wants to get the necklace back because it was her mother's. Like, that's her main goal. But also she wants to take down this evil person who killed her mom. So, you know, so they plan a heist, at the gala, which is the thing that her mother died at. It's like that annual gala that the Baroness throws. And, they come up with, you know, she teams up with Jasper and Horace and says, hey, you know, Horace has been trying to get some kind of a heist with her on the inside of the department store.
We have the angle.
Right. And so finally he's like, what are we going to do? What am I? And she's just like, I just want this necklace back. And he's like, you know, and he, at this point he's just like, okay, fine. Like, at least we're doing something. So they get to play it up, and he dresses up as like an exterminator. And it's so funny with the security guard at the door, like Tom was talking about. He's just like, yeah, no, good. Like, get out of here. He thinks he just wants to infiltrate the gala or whatever. And he's like, well, these rats are as big as a dog, man. And he turns around in the little pet, what's his name? Wink. Okay, Wink. He's got a patch on his eye.
Because he has one eye.
Yeah. So, so his name's Wink, and he's dressed up in a rat costume, and it's just, it's so adorable. But the guy's like, oh my God. And so he's like, I told you. And so he lets him in, and, you know, Horace is working on infiltrating to the vault, and Jasper's on monitor duty and trying to like cut the feed to all the security cameras and to replace it with a blank hallway, you know, the classic heist thing. And anyway, so they catch on to what they're doing, and they eventually capture Horace. And you know, there's this, oh, and meanwhile the ball is a black and white ball. And so this is where the scene that's in all the trailers and promotional stuff, she Hunger Games it. I mean, it's straight out of you know, what Lenny Kravitz did for Katniss. She shows up, and then, you know, she's basically trying to show up the Baroness at every turn. And she does the thing where, like, flames and gets the red dress and all this. But what's interesting,
she Mr. T's it.
Tell me.
In Rocky III, this is Mr. T showing up at Rocky's press conferences. He's like, if you ever want a real woman, a real man, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. Oh, my gosh. It's true. But what I really like about this dynamic, so Emma Thompson is just, I mean, like, I don't want to sound, you know, just, I don't know. I can't even find the word for something. But what I'm trying to say here is that she is so, like, devilishly, like, she's evil, but she eats this role up.
But it's with a purpose, because they have her going up against the Baroness. Like, you can, even when she's doing really lousy things, you're like, yeah, she's earned it.
Right.
But it's crazy. It's not over the top, though. Like, no, this could have been completely cartoony, and she straddles this line of being devious, but, like, kind of grounded at the same time.
That's
I'm completely invested in this world, and I believe her. She's indulging in the fact that we have this person trying to upstage her at her own event. She sits her down and talks to her, because ultimately, while she's probably going to have her killed in a matter of minutes,
she's interesting.
You're talented.
She's the most interesting person.
She has respect for her.
Yeah, because everyone else is below her in her mind. This person is on her level, and she's cunning and doing evil things, like, as in trying to ruin.
It's the first time she's had anyone that could really challenge her.
Toe to toe with her. Yeah, so that's what I was trying to look for. It's like, she's not over the top. It's
funny because, like, she's not over the top, but she is. But I think what you're where it gets kind of muddied and it benefits the film is that because it's set against the backdrop of high fashion.
There's lots of
big personalities in that industry.
Over the top is normal.
And there's lots of ludicrous looks that people have. So when she shows up in these over the top outfits, it doesn't feel anachronistic because that's exactly how people in that industry would comport themselves.
Yeah, good call. So, I mean, Emma Stone and Emma Thompson, both of them are phenomenal. And the Baroness is a character you love to hate.
Yeah.
She's so fantastic at being cruel and evil. And
Cruella is a character you hate to love.
Right, because right? you can't love help that. But
love
to.
It. Love it.
Right. It's exactly. What a great like yin and yang. Yeah. I mean, they really do complete one another.
And then we understand why. We
yes,
understand
because they are
the yin and yang.
Cut from the same cloth.
Right.
Which is kind of a fashion pun. And, they are, right. And so anyway, it's interesting. She's like, yeah, you're interesting. I want to talk to you. And Cruella's basically like, I'm going to be the most famous designer and all this. And then, you know, she's finally like, okay, arrest this person and arrest all these people and whatever. And I can't even remember. Hijinks ensue. What happens? How do they get out of that situation?
I don't know. Paul Horace the rats. Like dangling. The rats.
That was hilarious. Paul Walter Hauser. Okay, we've seen him. And speaking of iTanya,
iTanya, and he's and the Paul, the Atlanta
Richard,
movie,
Richard Jewell,
there we go.
And he is such a good actor. Oh, he was in
The Five Bloods.
Yep.
My favorite part about Jewell was when he sang "Who Will Save Your Soul."
Right?
Like, who would have guessed that
I
he
know.
Could have pulled that
what a
off?
Voice.
Like, I just lost in the character.
I know, right? I mean, he can really escape into a role, a true chameleon. But he's so great, and I thought he was hilarious in this. And awesome. I thought all of their accents. I mean, Jewell Fry seems like he's British. I'm guessing
I believe he is British.
But his last name's Fry. British.
I didn't mind Paul with it. Like his was like a kind of like. That aggressive bloke, you know?
Yeah.
But like it's
hold
fine.
On.
Like,
did Jewell Fry play the same character as Hugh Laurie?
Yeah.
In the old movie? Laurie and Fry, totally. What are the chances of all the actors in the world in the same property universe or whatever, same frame? I don't know, that's funny. So he's hilarious in this movie, and what I was gonna say is all their accents I think are really good for the Americans doing British accents. I mean, Emma Stone's was like, it took a little bit to get used to, but it was consistent. That's the thing, if you make an accent that's believable enough and you never go in and out of it,
right.
Which a lot of American actors, I mean, British people can drop the accent pretty easily. American actors trying to do British, you hear the in and out, and sometimes it's
And I don't think it's because British actors are better at it. I think what it is that they cast stars, American stars, and then they try to teach them to talk that way, where if the British actor can't do it, they're not a name.
True.
And so they don't even hire them.
True.
So like, you know, like if they, you know, if they were basing a casting of a role entirely on an accent, Kevin Costner would not be Robin Hood. But they want Kevin Costner to play Robin Hood. So by the way, get this guy a speech coach and let's see if we can
get
him.
And just
there.
Don't do the accent basically, right? He just doesn't do the accent pretty much in that movie.
I think
he
kind of drifts in and out a little bit.
It's pretty bad. So anyway, they get out of there, and from this point on, it's really just Cruella upstaging the Baroness at every turn. So
You know, now the MacGuffin is that the necklace that she wanted to be able to steal was not inside the vault, and it ended up, of course, it was on the Baroness's neck.
Yeah,
he was right there.
As hijinks ensue, one of the three Dalmatians in the Baroness's possession ends up swallowing the necklace. So
good
now the
call.
Goal is to steal the dog. So we kind of get the nod to we're going after puppies, but not for the reason what we think we are.
That's a good call, actually. Yeah. So she just wants to get the key back. So
and she even says it's going to come out the other end. She's not go cut the dog open. She's like, just wait for it to poop.
Exactly. So Horace ends up kidnapping them all from the puppy spa or whatever.
That was a very good play. I'm like, that is a really clever way to be able to kidnap these dogs without the dog wash.
This
movie
is smart. It really is. So, you know, they now Horace and Jasper are dog sitters, and you see all the zany stuff that happens with them, and they're just tearing up the place, whatever.
And they give us a very rare treat, which is a poop joke that's funny and establishes character development.
Remind me.
Well, because it establishes she doesn't want to kill the dog.
Oh, right.
Right? Like, so it's like, it was funny when she's like, it's going to boop, like, wait for it to come out. But it also sends the message of, like, she's not looking to kill a dog.
Right.
She'll just wait for it. So, like, it does, that one line does multiple things, which is quite a lot of heavy lifting for a poop joke.
Right. But you're right. It shows her intent, which is not to murder these puppies. You know, as it goes on, every fashion show the Baroness throws, Cruella shows up, and Artie's making her these incredible costumes. She's all over the news. She's become kind of like the Batman. You know, she's this like mysterious. The papers are reporting. No one knows who she is. I mean, it's a very like Batman-esque persona of, you know, she shows up and goes and no one can find
her. These elaborate stunts. I mean, you have the one where she locks Horace and Jasper lock the Baroness inside of her limo, and she comes out in this military bolero kind of like, you know,
regal blazer, and it's got a pants, and there's this dress with this super long train, and it's just appropriately draping the car so you can see the Baroness old. Peeking out so all the cameras can catch her, and a sash that says old.
And then she's the new. Yeah, it's so clever. I mean, as far as fashion, which I find interesting, like I don't know a lot about it, but I like to watch documentaries on fashion and how it's evolved and everything. And it's like this movie captures so much about the fashion world while doing.
And I have no interest in it. At all, which you can probably tell by how I dress, and so that's why I was really surprised that it
was
that,
so interesting.
That I enjoyed the
and
movie
captivating.
The way I did.
Yeah. So you see all these great outfits. Eventually she finds out the Baroness finds out that Cruella who she is, right?
Yeah, so she's definitely catching on.
Yeah, so she eventually is able to track her down after what isn't the last escapade where she does the golden beads or whatever.
Yeah, so she essentially, Estella is simultaneously planning all of these events to upstage the Baroness and still working in the house to kind of furnish these fashions for her. And while at the same time trying to develop her own line and what she's going to end up doing. And one of the most clever stunts we have is essentially we have the scene where Horace sneaks into the fashion house of the Baroness and delivers this like stunning jewels to be beaded on this dress. And like, this is nice back and forth of like, this is something Cruella will never have, right? It's going to be, it's super expensive. It's lavish. And it's a beautiful dress that Estella designs and that the Baroness steals from her to make it the prize piece of her show. And it's properly placed to where we can see Estella, we can see Horace, and that's where the Baroness puts it together. That I think that she is Cruella. She lets it plays out. She thinks she has the upper hand by telling them to stash the dress inside of a vault where all the rest of the dresses are, only to be released right before her spring show is going
to
happen.
Because they stage a fake break-in to show people are trying to steal the dresses.
That break-in was hilarious.
It was hilarious. We were trying to wake the guy up. But the brilliant thing of it, the break-in was fake, so she would lock him in the vault with the prize piece, which happens to be has moths that hatch.
I did not see that coming at all.
Not for a second.
And we get to see them using, that's what I was referring to, when like they're bumbling idiots, but they're fake bumbling idiots, right? Like, so it's clever.
It's very, so her whole line for the show is destroyed by moths, and then moths fly out and attack them. And then outside, they've done like this makeshift punk rock stage they've erected by this fountain outside of where the Baroness's show was, and they put on this huge show, and so it's a huge win for Cruella once again. She keeps getting the upper hand. So anyway, they get out of that, but meanwhile the Baroness puts it together. She has her henchmen capture
Horace and
Jasper. They get Horace and Jasper, and they're carted off by the police, I think. And then she kidnaps Estella Cruella and ties her up in their little
before she gets taken to the police. They said, hey, I'm going to pin your death on these two guys.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, wow, you are so evil.
Yes. She's just like deliciously evil, right? You just hate her, but she's so good in this role. Mm-hmm. And so they set their house, but it's not, you know, it's their.
It's like flat. It's like an abandoned flat or something. Yeah,
they're like squatting in this place for their whole life. But anyway, so they set it on fire, leave Cruella to die, and none other than Mark Strong, the big bad guy that you think is just evil henchman, is actually a nice guy, and he captures her, and he's like, I know the truth. Look at that necklace. That's a key. And he opens up a little safe with the key, and it shows her birth certificate. And we find out that the Baroness is actually Cruella's mother. They figure out that's why everything is the way that it is. And so now she has to figure out how to get her revenge. She breaks Horace and Jasper out of jail, just trying to move.
This is her Oscar moment, though, when she returns to the fountain, where her and her mom was supposed to go and have their first moment in London. And I've never seen a dramatic scene like this written in any Disney property, where it's a moment for Emma Stone to just completely turn, where she's like, I am no longer Estella. I am Cruella. And I don't even know, like, a part of me wants to be mad, but then not. Like, I kind of understand. You're like my other mom, but like not really. And
toggling back and forth between Estella and Cruella.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, how is this a Disney movie? Like, I don't mean that, like, I love Disney, but like, not that it's inappropriate, but just like, this is like next level.
Yes,
stuff.
Because they're hiring, mature. Because they're letting people make real movies. And again, I love Disney too. I'm not
this
saying
this is Craig Gillespie too, man. Like, right. This guy's got a track record.
Right. So it's like they're letting people make movies and they have Disney characters and a Disney stamp on them. But this is a movie that the studio clearly did not interfere with the artistic image or vision of it.
And it's a pretty bold move for Disney.
It is. And and I think it will pay off if people give this a chance.
But they marveled it, right?
Yeah.
Like they found a simple, you know, they were like, oh, well, what if we did Devil Wears Prada? But like, you know what I mean? Like,
exactly what they did.
They marveled it.
Yep.
And I mean that in the best possible way.
Right. So anyway, so this is where, you know, to get to the end. So they try to come up with a plan that the audience is really hidden from what's going to happen. You're like, what the hell is she going to do? Right. Yeah. And so anyway, she breaks Horace and Jasper out of jail. It's a cool scene. And they end up going to the Baroness. And I guess it's her. This is the actual gala. The other one was a black and white ball. This is like the gala where her mom died. I'm sorry about earlier. And so she confronts her and she's basically like, you know, tells her she knows that the Baroness is her mother. And she starts to be like, oh, that's the only explanation. No wonder you're so brilliant, you know, and the total villain fake out type of thing. Like, oh, come here and give me a hug right next to the cliff where the mother was killed, of course. And she pushes her off. But now Horace and Jasper and everyone have said that the Baroness wants them outside. So
it was all coordinated by Estella. She wanted she enters the party as Cruella. She's found this way to deviously send every guest on the guest list for this gala, a Cruella original that's completely caught off guard by the Baroness. She's overwhelmed and shocked because, like, one, to her thoughts, Cruella's dead.
Cruella's dead, and everyone shows up looking like Cruella. And she forces, this is a running thing throughout the whole movie, the Baroness toasts to herself and only herself, and she is forced to toast Cruella, her arch nemesis, who she's had killed. And you can just tell that it kills her, and she has to do it in front of her whole audience who looks like Cruella. It's amazing. But so they're all outside. They witness this. We find out later in a flashback that she invented a parachute in her costume and was able to get back to the party and all that stuff. You know, it's, I don't know how in time.
That definitely takes some suspension of disbelief.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know how all that happened that quickly because it was up on a hill and she's down in the water. Okay, whatever, it's a good movie. So, you know, but anyway, so everyone's witnessed this. She shows up as Cruella because this is, so like, she, like, what, like, metaphorically and literally, like, they've witnessed Estella die.
Yeah.
So it's really clever in that regard. So now on paper, Estella is dead, and now Cruella is her own person. And we're also left with that, you know, now Cruella, what are they going to do with this character?
Yes, essentially Estella as the rightful heir to the Hellman's, you know, wealth and everything that comes with it, because you know through the flashback we recognize that, you know, the Baroness was still the same, you know, bitch that she's always been, and like completely did not want this child, and her husband died of like a broken heart, like all Disney,
and he left everything to Estella, but the Baroness locked that away. So now she gets her castle, her huge mansion, all her money
bequeathed to Cruella,
right? So we don't know where the character is going to go. Now what I really like that we just glossed over is some of the Easter eggs and homages. So her school friend Anita, Baroness's lawyer who she fires, Roger. So of course,
I didn't put that together till the end of the
when
movie,
I saw
bro.
Anita, I'm like, oh, that's a nice nod.
Yeah,
well, Anita's the main
right
character.
Yeah, and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So
I go, that's a nice nod. No, that's the character
from
the movie, because in 101 Dalmatians, Anita and Roger fall in love over their Dalmatian puppies,
right,
who we find out that the Baroness's dogs, while our characters had them, made it or whatever. And you know what I mean? Sometime during that period, one got pregnant, they had puppies, and Cruella sends a puppy to Anita, her friend, and to Roger, the lawyer. And so that's how they're going to meet. It's a really cute way to set up the story that we know. And again, I don't think Cruella is going to play out the same way. And it will be interesting to see how they do it, because this movie is phenomenal. And if they didn't make a sequel, it would be a travesty. Like, this deserves.
I think this movie, and it's funny that Tom said they marvelized it, right? I don't know what's going to happen next, but I honestly wouldn't be mad if this was the springboard to essentially another interconnected universe, right? So a couple of things. One, I think it's really forward casting that found we got a black Anita and we got a brown Roger, right? Great. Because I think
part of why the head fake worked is because we were using our own cultural biases to go, well, that can't be those characters. because they're not the right race. And when it's why not? They were cartoon characters.
I thought it was just an homage.
Right.
But what it ended up being is an actual setup, which I thought was pretty brilliant. And man, when you see, you know, they get the puppies and then Roger starts writing the song, that's the song.
I knew that much. Yeah
you've seen sing-alongs and stuff like that. So when he starts singing that, I'm like, what a great tag on the end of this movie.
Now, he has no reason to write that song.
Yeah.
Because like he's had very little interaction with Cruella.
Yeah.
Right. And essentially the song is about how dastardly this woman is and he barely knows her. And he just got a dog from her.
I think a good setup for a sequel, which is the animated cartoon that we know and love. He's behind the creation of it, and she's mad about it because it made her look like a piece of shit.
Take that storyline, and then now whole movie and make it a story,
right?
And she can have other revenge.
Now you keep that movie alive, but then she's like, "But that's not who I am, and that's not what really happened."
Well, I mean, if you don't know, in the live action Glenn Close version, Roger's a video game designer instead of a music composer, and makes a video game where Cruella is the villain.
Really?
So you just took the same concept and just made the actual like meta movie,
right,
as something Roger makes, and she's mad at him. So it is
right. Yeah.
Did you catch Anita's last name in the film?
No, what is it?
Darling.
Oh, what right. Right, because I'm like, a Peter Pan.
Yes. So,
homage.
Like, I mean, if they want to, if this could kind of like segue into like a simultaneous kind of like Peter Pan thing, like maybe like
she's a descendant.
Anita is the distant cousin of Wendy and the rest of the Darling
time period. But, you know, that's like 1800s, I think. But she could be a relative. Like,
many different retellings of that story. Yeah. I have no problem in letting it take place as this goes on. I mean, and because of how successful this villain origin story is that I couldn't care for at all, give me Hook. If you want to give me Cruella ended up hooking up with Captain Hook before he was Captain Hook and before he went to Neverland, I'll take it.
How great would it be to get a version of Hook that's not awful?
Well, I have one, actually. You may not have seen it.
Understand. I love Dustin Hoffman's Hook. I love
Hook,
it.
Too. Yeah. Hook's brilliant. So.
But anyway, this movie was absolutely amazing. I was flabbergasted by how much I enjoyed this movie.
When I reviewed it, I'm pretty sure I gave it an A. I'm like, this movie is phenomenal. And that's why it hurts me so bad to see people like just making fun of it and never giving it a chance. Because it's like, you know, if people did this about your snobby art house movies, because these are the same people, an origin story, and she's killed by Dalmatians, whatever. These are the same people that, I'm not saying all of them, but some of them can get a little pretentious.
Totally.
And if a plebe did that about one of their art house movies, they would say, oh, well, you just don't watch enough good movies. Oh, all you watch is Transformers. So, you know, it goes both ways.
Yeah. Can make good, big budget, crowd-pleasing movies, too. It doesn't have to be either or.
People made up their minds about this, and it sucks. Like, I mean, I know Rotten Tomatoes is far from perfect, but I will say whoever writes those critic consensus for this site is pretty great. The critics' consensus on this, Cruella can't quite answer the question of why its title character needed an origin story. Why is that a question for a critic at all? Why a story is necessary?
No stories are necessary.
Yeah, I've been a long-time proponent. I'm sure I've mentioned on the show a lot of times. Should I backtrack? So
the pass-fail nature of Rotten Tomatoes.
And I am of belief, though, that when people go, but why? Why do we need this? I don't know. Why do we need any story? Yeah. It's a story.
Yes.
If you don't want to watch it, don't watch it. But people are out there telling stories. And if it's good, you can be surprised and go, that's great. If it's bad, never think about it again. But I hate when people go, that was unnecessary or whatever. You know, that didn't need to happen. It's like, who are you to say? It's a story. It's, you know.
Totally.
In this case, it can be really good. So I say give things a chance.
Absolutely.
This is great.
But it was a great movie. So anyway, I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Kevin. You can follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And Colby, where can everybody find you and your wares?
Yeah, you can find your boy. I'm on all the socials at Colby Told Me. That's KOLBYTOLD me. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Clubhouse. So when they ask you where you heard it from, you can tell them Colby Told Me.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Find the show online, Facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. And of course, don't forget our Patreon. So that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, Miranda sacrifices Nigel to keep her job.
Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice because we already warned you. We'll be right back.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.